Well, these days when you go over to a friend's house, you're more likely to trip over squeaky toys, chew bones, and treat balls than you are to step on Legos or crayons. And that's because more American households have pets now than they have children. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And who's taking care of all these pets when they get sick? Well, veterinarians, of course. Demand for veterinarians is growing faster than a golden retriever puppy. And that's one of the reasons the job site Indeed recently named being a veterinarian as the best job for 2025. But is checking dogs and cats for fleas and ticks really the ticket to a fulfilling career? Well, we're going to find out. Our guest is Dr. Calico Schmidt. She is a doctor of veterinary medicine with the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she ran a small animal practice for 24 years. What do you want to know about being a veterinarian? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Schmidt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here today, and hopefully we'll represent well all of the veterinarians out there.
There's a lot of them, but probably not enough, right?
Yeah, it's a growing need, I think, and certainly all of our students at the veterinary school have not had trouble finding a job because there's so much need for veterinarians across the U.S.
And across the board, too, from little to big animal.
Yes, definitely so, especially in rural practice. There's definitely been a need for large animal veterinarians, too.
Yeah, because it's not an easy job, especially when big animals. I mean, because big animals
indeed
are big animals.
So. It requires a whole different set of muscles and skills, definitely.
Yeah, muscles, I think, is key. So I think what we need to do is have people read, you know, James Herriot books, and then they'll want to become a veterinarian.
Yes.
Maybe not. Right?
I loved those when I was little, too, and certainly that contributed to my wanting to be a veterinarian as well.
Yeah, I did too. I think that they're so much fun. So I guess before we start with, well, my producer wanted me to ask you about your name. So Calico, of course, is a type of cat.
Indeed.
Did that make you want to become a veterinarian?
You know, it's a really good question. I love cats. And interestingly, my dad is not a huge cat fan. At least he wasn't when I was little. But my dad is an interior decorator, and my mom went to school in textiles. And so they named me after the fabric.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I've definitely had people ask me, did you change your name because you're a veterinarian and you love cats? And nope. I think it was just meant to be.
I think that's hilarious. Yes, I changed my name to match my profession.
Yes.
That happens all the time.
Of course.
Okay, so what type of education do you need to pursue to become a veterinarian? I mean, how do you even start, like, in high school? What should you be focusing in on?
That's a great question. And, of course, a focus for veterinary medicine is science. So if you're a high school person interested in becoming a veterinarian, taking all of the science courses that you can will be really helpful. One thing that our admissions team really looks at is grades. So really studying hard and doing your best grade-wise is really helpful, whether it be in high school or college leading up to veterinary school. The other thing that I think is really helpful that our admissions committee also looks at is animal experience and just broad experiences, not even all having to do with animals. So get some experience with small animals, dogs and cats, with large animals. Go volunteer at a dairy farm or take care of horses or learn to train or ride horses. All of those things will show that you're a well-rounded individual with a great interest in animals.
And I'm sure lots of people out there would love to have someone volunteer to clean out their stalls and their horse barn, too.
Indeed.
Right?
Anything like that is helpful.
Well, being around animals really, really, I mean, it's good for everybody. I think unless, of course, there's unfortunate allergies involved.
Yes.
But so volunteering, humane societies, that type of thing.
Yes, humane societies always need help. Mm-hmm. A lot of humane societies and animal rescues are now fostering lots of different animals. So foster pets in your own home. Mm-hmm. Take courses. Help with training courses for animals. Any experience you can get is wonderful.
Yeah. And reading, I would assume?
Yes, reading about animals. Anything you can do.
Yeah, 4-H is a good place too, right?
Oh, beautiful. Yes, 4-H. Mm-hmm. A lot of our students end up having some experience in 4-H or FFA, which is Future mm-hmm. Farmers of America. We have a number of students who've grown up on dairy farms or helped with dairy farms, especially in Wisconsin.
Okay, so you're doing all this when you're in high school. What do you do then? Because you don't go to veterinary school right away. You still have to get your undergraduate degree.
Correct.
So what areas do you focus on? Is there a specific degree for people that want to go on to veterinary school?
That's a really cool thing about veterinary medicine is there's not really a specific major that you need in order to apply to veterinary school. So you can major in anything that you wish to as long as you complete all of the prerequisite courses, which, as you'd imagine, are mostly in the sciences, and communication as well is important. Having some basic chemistry and anatomy and physiology, all of those are really good things. So we have people who have majored in communication and in finance and you name it, as long as you get all those prerequisites in, you're a good candidate for veterinary school.
Oh, that's great. Now, is there a test you take, like an LSAT you take for law school? Is there?
There used to be. Okay. So we used to have a graduate school admissions test that people took. Our school is no longer requiring that because we found that it kind of overlooked some students who weren't able to take that test. So the application process is basically an application form that one fills in where you share all of your educational experience and the grades that you received. You share all of your animal experiences, and then we get thousands of applicants and have to narrow those down to 100 students per class.
Oh, 100.
That's the hard part.
Oh, my gosh. And there aren't a lot of veterinary schools in the state, right?
Correct. There's a growing number. We now have some additional schools who have opened up, but I think at last count we have about 27 veterinary schools in the U.S., so not every state has one.
No.
And it's a bit of a competitive process, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that. Now, what about schools outside of the United States? I know that can happen with medical degrees. Does that happen with being a veterinarian?
Absolutely. So there are schools in other countries around the world. The difficult part there is if one graduates from a school in another country, for most of those students, when they come to the United States, if you're interested in practicing here, you have to take a special veterinary licensing exam. Since not all schools are the same, they just want to make sure everyone has the knowledge and skills to successfully be a veterinarian in the U.S.
Does your license cover like the state you're in? If you move to another state, do you have to get that license also?
That's a great question as well. So once we graduate from veterinary school, we take a veterinary licensing exam that's a national exam. So that's required for anyone who practices in the U.S. And then individual states also have their own specific requirements. So to practice in Wisconsin, for example, when I graduated, I took a test just to make sure that I knew all of the veterinary regulations and rules pertaining to Wisconsin.
Oh, sure.
And different states have varying requirements, but they're fairly similar.
Okay. And of course, they probably change a lot too. So you have to keep up with everything.
Indeed.
It's not just the medical stuff. You have to keep up with the other stuff too.
The paperwork, yes.
What is it like when you get in, you're one of those 100 people. What does your studying look like? What does your day look like?
That's changing a little bit, at least at the UW-Madison's Veterinary School. So when I was in school and up until this year, much of a student's day involves being right at the veterinary school, attending lecture courses, and then there are labs and activities that we complete as well for the first 3 years. We are right now undergoing a huge curriculum revision in which students will be doing a little bit more self-directed learning, where they'll perhaps be watching lectures on videotape, and then they'll come to school, and we really want to get them active using the knowledge that they've studied on their own. So that will occur during the first 3 years for students. And then during the final fourth year, all students complete a series of clinical rotations, which right now are a series of two-week rotations where they may be with our primary care general practitioners for 2 weeks. They spend time in the large animal hospital, the small animal hospital. They can go off to other hospitals if they have particular interests, maybe with zoos or wildlife or research. So they can sort of craft their own experience the fourth year, while there are certain rotations that are required of everybody.
Sure. That makes sense to get that general, the basics down. Now, the job site Indeed ranked veterinarian as the best job of 2025. Did you know about that until we contacted you?
I didn't. Okay. I was a little bit surprised, although excited
yeah.
to hear that. Yeah.
So why do you think that becoming a veterinarian is a smart career choice? Let's do the pros.
The pros first.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the things that anyone might imagine is, I think for someone who loves animals, it allows you to work with those things that you love every day of your life, which is really fun. And I think an unexpected part, at least for me, was just finding the joy of working with the people who come along attached to those animals. I think some research has shown that many people who go into veterinary medicine are a little bit introverted, and we like being in the quiet and with our animals. However, just talking with the people that come along with those animals is a joy. And for me, that's part of my social network, is the people that I've gotten to know as clients who come with their animals. So those are really some of the joys, just working with the animals, working with their people. Our day is often filled with a lot of variety, so we could be seeing a new puppy or kitten for a wellness visit and vaccinations in one appointment, and then for our next appointment, we may be seeing a senior animal who's very ill, and we need to help find out what's wrong and make a diagnosis and help with treatment.
Sure. And I think that's a lot of what people maybe don't think about ahead. It's like you do have to deal with the sad, hard parts of it too. And, you know, like I said, I was surprised about the best job because I had heard these reports on the mental health issues that the veterinarian community has had. So what are those cons?
That's a really good question as well, because I think part of my surprise in hearing why veterinary medicine was ranked as a top job is that there's also been quite a bit of publicity that working as a veterinarian makes one at risk maybe 2 to 4 times more likely to die by suicide rather than versus people who are members of the general public. And I think that's because of perhaps some of the stressors of the job. And I think for many veterinarians, one hard thing is that we're not perfect. We can't cure every single disease that's out there while we want to. And of course, that's why we get into this profession. We want animals to be happy and healthy. So I think that's one difficulty. I think another is that many people who become veterinarians, you know, for us, that's part of our identity. And so it becomes very difficult to separate work from home life, and that work-life balance is really difficult. So many veterinarians bring their work home with them. For our students, we're trying really, really hard to help them understand that there's a difference between work and home. And in order to be able to help our animals and their people, we need to be healthy too, or we can't help. So mental health has become really, really important.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, how you prepare your students for that, because it is rough, and you're treating an animal who can't tell you where it hurts, right? And that makes it really difficult to diagnose. So that's hard. How's the reaction been when you talk about these things to the students?
I think students are all, you know, they're very smart, intelligent people, and that's how they get to where they are. Mm-hmm. So I think many of them, especially because they've spent time shadowing other veterinarians or working at shelters, they really do understand that there are some difficulties and hardships they're going to have to face. So I think they come to it with a very realistic view of things. We're trying very hard to help foster those professional skills for them that allow them to build mental health for themselves, understand when they're experiencing anxiety and stressors, and helping them to find ways to work through that so they can be happy and healthy and really serve the animals and their people best.
Sure. Is that also happening in the profession for those who are already veterinarians?
Yes, okay, indeed. There have been a number of studies looking into veterinary well-being and ways that we can foster that for veterinarians who are in practice.
Wonderful. Dr. Calico Schmidt is our guest today. She's a doctor of veterinary medicine with the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. What questions do you have about being a veterinarian? How important is a good veterinarian to your family? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Jill Nadeau for WPR News. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the state of Wisconsin fisheries with a panel of experts. And we'll also get the latest on land conservation trusts. That's starting tomorrow at 11 right here. But right now, we are talking about the joys and challenges of being a veterinarian with our guest, Dr. Calico Schmidt. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Beverly in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Beverly.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've always been curious why the vet medicine hasn't found a way to deal with its shortage of vets the way that human health care did. Because, you know, a long time ago, there were just med techs, nurses, and doctors. And then they put in the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants for a high level of care, but not quite that of the doctor. But fact saying that veterinary medicine is not dealing with its shortage of vets in this way at all. I'm curious why or if that's maybe going to change.
Great. That's an excellent question, Beverly.
Thank you for that question, Beverly. I think it's very insightful, and I think we're going to see some changes in that area very soon. Colorado has just enacted a bill which basically allows for a veterinary equivalent of a veterinary nurse practitioner. And as you can imagine, there's been a little bit of controversy going back and forth because we also have our wonderful veterinary technicians, or we call them veterinary nurses, who go to school specifically to help in a similar capacity to what human nurses do. So I have a feeling that may trickle across the United States so that we may have some mid-level practitioners as well. And I think another way that's been addressed, too, is that there are additional veterinary schools who are opening across the United States. I think in the last year, I'm not going to know the number, but we have a number of new veterinary schools that are admitting people to try and help with this problem.
Because we are becoming so pet-centric in our lives that we really do need more. Because sometimes you call and you can't get in unless it's an emergency for weeks.
Yeah, that's been a really big concern that we're trying really hard to mitigate. So
absolutely,
we're working on it, Beverly. Thank you.
that's a great idea. Hopefully that will take off. So we mentioned that you can specialize in dogs, cats, small animals. There's also or companion animals, as they call it. And then there's also big animals. So can you kind of tell us the difference and what other categories can people specialize in?
Well, that's a beautiful question. And that's one of the really cool things about veterinary medicine, too, because I think a lot of students enter vet school knowing they want to do something with animals. And while you're in veterinary school, you don't have to know right away. You can choose based on what really interests you in school. So we have people who are interested in being that kind of James Harriet practitioner that we call a mixed animal practitioner, working with companion animals as well as large animals. And most of our students end up going into companion animal practice, working with dogs and cats. Some will add in some of we call them special species or exotics, like birds and lizards and snakes and rabbits and things like that. So that's one arm of veterinary practice. We have many practitioners, especially with our state being such a big dairy industry, who choose to go into food animal or production animal medicine, where they may work with dairy farms all day. And some of them, of course, work with other types of food-producing animals like swine or poultry. And then we have equine veterinarians who work with horses that are basically a big version of companion animals and also athletes. So there are equine practitioners. There are also opportunities in zoo animal medicine and working in wildlife or working in shelter animal medicine. And then we have people who are very interested in learning more about ways to help with both human and animal disease. So they pursue a job in veterinary research. We have veterinarians who go to school and earn a little extra degree in public health. So there are public health veterinarians who work to basically help prevent and treat diseases that are found in both animals and people. Like I'm sure you've heard of influenza, H5N1 influenza, and that can affect people as well as animals. So there are some specialized veterinarians who help in that field. There are veterinarians who go into industry and work with drug industries or food industries to help produce safe and effective drugs and foods for our animals and for people as well. So huge variety of things one can do. I'm sure I have missed some and I apologize for those that I have.
Yeah, well, there sounds like there's a lot of little niches for everybody to kind of fit in.
And some people even swap. I worked with a large animal practitioner in my very first job who worked mostly on dairy farms, and as he got older, he started having some aches and pains, and he ended up, because he just could no longer do that physical job of being a large animal vet, he ended up working with companion animals. So you can swap mid-career, which is pretty cool.
Definitely. Justin in Wapaka emailed, he advises pre-veterinary students at the collegiate level, and he says that currently it is easier to be accepted into medical school than vet school. And he says if there is a great need for veterinarians, why not open vet schools to let more students with less than stellar transcripts and resumes?
Oh, that's a really packed question.
Yes,
thank you
is.
For that one. I think part of the challenge that we face there is that there are only, because we have only a limited number of veterinary schools and a limited number of spaces, we're a little bit restricted. And so while a large emphasis is grades that you receive, it's certainly not the only thing we look at. And we've relaxed some of those standards a little bit. Not that the students we admit are not stellar and wonderful, because they all are. And we also will look heavily at what other experiences those students have had. So it's kind of an interesting puzzle, and we're working on it.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for that question, Justin. Appreciate that. How common is it for veterinarians to open their own practice?
That's a good question, too. I think that's becoming a little bit less common in today's world, because there are so many financial challenges that people face in owning their own business. I know there's a trend toward privately owned practices as those folks who run the practices become eligible for retirement. A lot of them end up selling their practice to a larger firm that manages multiple practices across the U.S.
Okay.
So I think it's becoming less and less common to own your own practice. But that being said, it's still a dream of many of our students, and it's still definitely attainable.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, you know, money. Obviously, it's not cheap to go to any schools. I mean, yeah. Medical schools, there's a lot of debt usually.
Yes.
Veterinarians don't make a lot of money. So, I mean, some do, obviously, but in general, they don't. So is there help for students who need that money to go to school?
There is some help, which is a good thing. Frustratingly, many of our students end up graduating with very large sums of debt, and that's one of the reasons as well that it's difficult for them to open a practice, especially right out of vet school, because they've got years to pay off debts.
Yes.
Ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
Our school is lucky in that we offer a number of scholarships to people, so there's scholarship money available. There are also some federal programs, especially in the area of rural practice. So if students will go and agree to practice in a rural area, they can have some of their debt repaid or get help with repaying debts.
Mm-hmm.
So there are definitely some programs. We'd love to have more.
Definitely. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 70% of veterinarians are women. Why do you think that that's happening like that?
Well, that's a really good question, too. And it's interesting to reflect on that, because when I went to veterinary school, which was a number of years ago, I think there were still more men than women in our class, and that has definitely changed in recent years. And I don't know if there's one specific reason. I think there are a number of possibilities. One of them has finances as a root, and that is, as you noted, veterinarians don't make a ton of money. So there was one hypothesis that perhaps men were dissuaded from entering a veterinary medical career because they saw that they weren't able to make money, and so that opened up some places for women. I don't know how true that is. Certainly, I know that many women care for animals very deeply, and of course men do as well. So it's been a really interesting trend. Now I'd say more than 70% of our students are women.
That really is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when you think about large animal, because, you know, not to be stereotypical, but men tend to usually be stronger, bigger, can handle, you know, a big old cow. So
yes. And that's really interesting, too. I remember when I was thinking about veterinary school, initially I was pondering being a mixed animal practitioner, and I'm not very tall in stature, and some people expressed concerns about that. But then I had others who told me, you know, you don't have to be a huge, really, really strong person, because we're very lucky these days to have drugs to help us sedate animals and help us manipulate them in ways that we need them to move.
That's
so
very true.
You don't have to be a big, bulky person. You can do it.
And you've got small hands, so. You know.
That's right. There are advantages.
There absolutely are. So what are some of the things that have changed as far as schooling goes since you were in school?
Some of the changes, I would say, are related to we now have the ability more so where we'll help students do what we call tracking, where they can choose and select at some schools right from day one, at some schools not until year two or year three of veterinary school, and it's a four-year schooling program. But we allow students to choose an area of interest so that they can take courses that guide them more in that direction. So someone who's really interested in, for example, practicing with dairy cattle doesn't have to take all of their classes related to dogs and cats.
Sure.
Of course, everyone has to take those basic courses so they can pass the national exam.
Mm-hmm.
But we have much more availability for kind of specializing a little bit or choosing where you wish to go in veterinary school.
And what help do you have for people who, you know, first year of anything new is going to be a struggle, obviously, for
yes.
some people. So how do you help first year, second year get through that?
Well, that's a really good question, because it does tend to be, I think, one of the biggest difficulties is that there's just so much information to learn. So we try and help students understand that you can't know it all. We're going to try and teach you all that we can and give you a good scaffold on which to build additional knowledge, and then help you think about ways that you will be able to gain more knowledge and keep up your knowledge after you graduate. So how do you assess resources to know that they are scientifically evidence-based? And how do you think critically about cases? And how do you look things up if you aren't quite sure that you know the answer?
So more about how to rather than the spewing back of
yes.
information. So what sources are there for people who, once they graduate, to keep up on all the things that are new, because that's changing so fast?
Oh, it is. I looked up a while back how short the time period is between when how long it takes for medical knowledge to double, and it's phenomenally short. So there's no
yeah.
way that you can know it all. So we try and give students an idea of, when you see, for example, a journal article or something on a website, how do you assess that to know whether that is something scientifically sound that you can believe? So some of the resources that we help students assess are different websites. There are great websites that are oriented towards specialties. For example, there's a Companion Animal Parasite Council that offers wonderful advice about parasites for dog and cat vets. And there are lots of really good practice guidelines put out by some nationally known veterinary organizations. So those are some things that we steer students toward. And then just help them think about, how do I find some of those resources that are going to grow and change as I'm in practice?
So a big part, I would assume, of being a vet is keeping up with all
yes.
of the new changes.
Yes.
That takes a lot of time, too.
It does. And we have requirements. Every state has continuing education requirements. So we have to learn new things and keep up in order to stay licensed.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us today.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate that. Thank you to Dr. Calico Schmidt. She is a practicing veterinarian at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And I'd like to thank my team of... Okay, I didn't write this. Doggone team of perfect staffers. Oh, Jeff, you're going to pay for that one. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and of course, our regular host, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. Stay tuned, lots more right here at WPR News.